J8. Number 3A.
Yeah, so if we take a look now at just simply how one defines that term government, seeing that this is the subject that is under discussion. Government means, when we look it up in the dictionary, especially Merriam-Webster, always who governs whom. It's always a relationship between two parties, and something is governing something. So who is governing whom? It's a relationship always between a governor and the governed. To govern means to regulate, just a typo there. It means to exercise power and authority in controlling others. But this is a terrific definition in Merriam-Webster for government. It says, the complex of laws through which the function of governing is carried out. And that is the way we would see in Christian Science, the science of Christian Science, probably the best definition then for government. The complex of laws, you see, through which the function of governing is carried out. And therefore that takes it totally away from when we get into theocracy, any sense of the human involved with governing. It certainly will take it finally into those laws which are the laws of God, and it's through those complex laws of God that God governs the universe. So now, as we go on to the big next category under consideration, which would be then point two for today, would be the science of government. Now, as I mentioned, that this whole subject is found and has its basis in Max Kepler's book, Christian Government, Its Scientific Evolution. This was the first book that Max wrote in around 1946 to back up the work of John Dorley. And it was at the time then in 1946 that Dorley was being excommunicated from the Christian Science Church organization. Because of what they called personal teachings. And at that time, when Max wrote this book called Christian Government, Its Scientific Evolution, then Max was excommunicated along with John Dorley on the basis mainly of this book that came out. And in Dorley's statement that he gave out in 1946, which gives you his statement on his scientific method and the science behind his work in Christian Science. He also, in there, will give you all the correspondence between himself and Boston that led to his excommunication. He's very straightforward with the letters that went on in between the two parties. And in there he mentions Max Kepler's book on Christian government and how important it is for one to study it. So this whole subject then that I give in the last half of the class is based on that book. Now, this subject of the science of government, and as a point one, we are talking about the law of God. And what we see then in the manual on Article 1, Section 9 in the Christian Science Church manual, Mrs. Eddy says that law constitutes government. So we want to ask ourselves, well, what is the meaning of the term law? And we've seen now that how important the three degrees are, that law of reformation that takes us from the first degree of the physical to the second degree of the moral, finally into the third degree of the spiritual. That is kind of like a grid you can put upon any evolution. All evolution seems to be going through those big three main stages. You'll find the same stages in the terminology in the Bible when they say, and he came out of Egypt, through the wilderness, and into the promised land. You find that a lot in the 3,000-year period in biblical history. At the time, of course, of Moses that brought the children of Israel out of the first degree of Egypt, physicality, through the wilderness. That's that second degree of the moral, which is that crisis period, because you're being taken out of one place and you're going somewhere else. You're being taken out of Egypt and you're going to the promised land, and you're in that second degree of the moral, that transitional stage that can be a wilderness period, and finally into the third degree of the promised land. So evolution of anything, whether it's government, whether it's whatever you're considering, can be seen through these three degrees from what we can see. Now, if you take this term law, we see, well, there are those first degree physical laws. And those laws are laws that are said to exist in nature itself. They're what they call scientific laws. And they say that these laws operate whether the human mind or nature takes notice of them or not. Well, that's under discussion today. They say that what they call the physical laws of the universe are just laws that have been created by the human brain. And that if the human brain had other conceptual tools, it would discover other laws behind the universe besides what they call physical laws. In fact, what they call physical laws may be spiritual laws misunderstood. For example, the law of gravity, they call a physical law, but that's really just a law of mind in its spiritual adhesion, cohesion, and attraction. But these are things we'll see. But mainly, if we look at it from the standpoint of the physical laws, there are scientific laws that are said to exist in nature. And these laws are given good definition in Webster. I mentioned that earlier. And this is a basic law that is seen in the spiritual realm also. It's only the spiritual always gives higher meaning to these definitions. But this one of law is basic and is very good. In Webster, it says that to define the term law, Webster Dictionary says that law is a statement of an order or relation of phenomena that is invariable under given conditions. So a law is an order of events, you could say, that is invariable. When you have an invariable order that never changes, and it just keeps repeating itself over and over and over and over, to that invariable order they've given the name law. Law is an observed regularity of nature. Or in the American Heritage Dictionary, law is a generalization based on the observation of repeated events. Now, these, just because God has to do with laws, I thought we should spend a little more time talking about laws so we get more law-oriented than people-oriented. Now, when we think of the term law, what is a law? Well, first of all, then we'd have to see what is the scientific method of arriving at laws. Well, first of all, then let's see that a law is a method of an abstraction. A law always takes a multitude of phenomena and reduces it to its basic elements. And then the law always defines the invariable, unchangeable order of those elements. This is a method which is economical. It does more with less. Now, if we just take, for example, and I certainly am no authority to teach the law of gravitation, but seeing that Max Kepler has presented it in his book on a study aid for the science of Christian Science on page 92, let's take a look at this law and see if just in big, big general terms, without trying to feel we're any authority in discussing the issue, let's take a look at this law of gravitation, just the way it's set up, to bring out the issue that a law is a method of abstraction and is a method of economy. It does more with less. They say that the law of gravitation is one of the greatest generalizations achieved by the human mind. So if we look in Kapler's book on the study aid, you'll see that he's talking here about the formation of phenomena. That's events, happenings, information, into a scientific law. And he shows here a nice picture of a tree with an apple falling, a nice picture of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, let's say with a stone falling, and the earth and the moon and the flood tides. Or he could have had a little picture right here of a spaceship leaving the earth going to the moon. All examples of a multitude of phenomena. You have different events occurring here. You have an apple, as I say, falling from a tree, a stone falling from a tower, and let's take a spaceship going to the moon. All this many phenomena, all can be explained under one law, called the law of gravity. So the law of gravity will take this multitude of phenomena, those many events, and we reduce all those events to their basic elements. And therefore, that is seen through this equation, where it says law, and then it will say F equals G, and then M subscript 1 multiplied by M subscript 2 divided by R2. Well, that's an equation, isn't it? I think we know the famous one also of Einstein's E equals MC squared, where energy equals mass and mass equals energy. So they take a law, will take this multitude of phenomena and reduce it down to its basic elements, and it will put it all together in an equation. Now, therefore, that is the method, but we're just getting out of it, that this is the method of abstraction. And it will not only take that multitude of phenomena and reduce it to its basic elements, but it will show how there's an invariable order within these elements. So as again, just to keep going with this law, therefore we have the multitude of phenomena, of the apple falling from the tree, the stone falling from the tower, the spaceship going to the moon. And the law of gravity reduces all that phenomena to its basic elements. And what are those basic elements? They're F, which equals force. G stands for gravity. M subscript 1 can stand for the apple, the stone, or the spaceship. M2 can stand for the earth, and R2 can be the distance squared. That's all the different phenomena reduced to its basic elements as symbolized in this equation. But a law also defines the invariable relationship amongst these elements. How are the invariables shown in this law? Through all these little symbols. F equals G, that equalizing never changes. That's a basic invariable element, the equalizing sign. And then another basic element to show an invariable relationship that never changes is multiplication, that M1 is multiplied by M2. And another relationship that shows an invariable, that this is an invariable order shown in this equation, is division, that line, that symbolized division, that never changes. And R2, the squaring never changes. So you see, a law is really wonderful, how it can take all the different phenomena in being as a method of abstraction and reduce it to its basic elements. and show how those elements are invariable. They never change. This is the method of economy. And remember how Mrs. Eddy talked about in the very beginning there, she says, both science and consciousness are now at work in the economy of being. See, that's already talking about law. It's a method of economy. Science and consciousness are now at work in the economy of being. They're doing more with less. And then she goes on to explain it. According to the law of mind, which ultimately asserts its absolute supremacy. So she's showing that what's going on in the universe is the operation of these laws of God, which are our abstractions, which are economical. Isn't that wonderful? It's just terrific how one can see that. It takes it totally, totally away from any government by human opinions or human whims or some despotic will of some madman, and puts ultimate government in the hands of God according to the laws of God. Laws which are invariable, yet vary according to certain events. Now, there are not only these scientific laws which can be shown in equation, but there are other laws that we talk about, not only scientific laws, but in the spiritual realm, and especially in this retranslation going on, there are moral laws. These are laws that are said to govern the behavior of man. They're man-made laws, which depend upon human mind and nature, whether you want to obey them or not. See, laws inherent in nature, like the scientific law of gravity in the physical law, they say, doesn't matter whether you obey it, you say you're going to obey it or not. You're under the law of gravity, whether we like it or not, see. But the moral laws, they say, well, that depends on human nature, whether you want to obey them or not. They're man-made laws. So there are other laws, these moral laws, and the definition for these type of laws that we deal with would be, as we see in the American Heritage Dictionary, law is a rule established by authority, society, or custom. Law is the body of rules governing the affairs of man within a community or among states, social orders. Or, we see under Black's Law Dictionary, that law is that which must be obeyed and followed by citizens, subject to sanction or legal consequences. So now, these laws then therefore are what we would call moral laws. And these are laws that you would find, for example, in the Bible. These would be like the commandments. They call those moral laws or ethical laws. That those thou shalt do and thou shalt not do. Those are under moral codes. Other examples besides the commandments of the thou shalt and thou shalt not, other types of moral laws would be these laws that, for example, Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes, in his political philosophy, wanted to and did talk about the differentiation between physical laws and this second degree of moral laws. Now, Hobbes himself put out, therefore, that there were two fundamental laws governing the universe under his social contract theory. He said, first there were the laws of nature. We can hear these are those physical laws that just exist in being. He says, those are the laws of preservation. Really what he called the law of self-preservation. He said, that exists in being. And he says, that is something like the law of the jungle, the law of tooth and claw, the law of might makes right. He said that those laws which he said exist in being, but we look at and we can see they're really more or less moral laws, but he called them laws that exist in being, natural laws. He says the reason for this first law, which we can see is really has a lot to do with the nature of man, he says because man is fundamentally untrustworthy, a corrupt being, and he has to protect himself from his fellow man. So therefore he, from this standpoint, has to obey what these laws of nature, which he calls laws of nature, laws in order to preserve himself. Because basically man being animal, physical, being untrustworthy and corrupt, constantly fighting each other, he says that in order to preserve oneself, therefore from this law of the jungle, the law of tooth and claw, the law that Mike makes right, that we have to go by in order to protect ourselves. And there, that law really is more or less what one sees is that's that law that would justify war, wouldn't it, in killing others. Then he says there is another law, a second law of nature. And this is more what he would give the moral laws, which he calls the law of social contract, the law of the golden rule. And this is, of course, the law that he hopes we move towards is away from the law of self-preservation, the law of tooth and claw, the law of might makes right, which justifies war. And he said that because there is that first law of self-preservation, it's going to compel human beings to come into the moral law, the law of social contract, where he said that the best situation for self-preservation is through a social contract, that where we build a contract together and on a moral basis, and where a society is in a social contract. And in that social contract, we have lasting peace. And if we agree to disagree within a social contract, that is the highest way for self-preservation. That if there is peace according to a social contract, that's the best way to preserve oneself. You see? So that's a sense of the law of golden rule, to do unto others as you would have them do unto us, a moral law in order for us to get the highest sense of preserving ourselves. So we see that, therefore, that there are differentiations between scientific laws, laws that exist in being itself, like the physical law of gravitation, or what Hobbes would call the laws of nature, the laws of self-preservation, or these moral laws, his law of social contract, or, as we would see in the Bible, the Ten Commandments, the law of what we should do and what we shouldn't do, the golden rule, really these moral laws, ethical laws. Now, when we take a look at, we've seen then the physical laws and then the moral laws. Now, what about the spiritual laws? How would we define spiritual laws? Well, that would then be laws, as we see from the third degree. These spiritual laws, we say yes, that those laws are laws, like they talk about the law of gravity, that it exists in being itself. We say, well, from the spiritual standpoints, a spiritual law is a law that exists in reality itself. But we define law according to the seven synonymous terms for God, Mrs. Eddy did in the textbook. So you will see, if you knew the system, you would hear how she defined law from its origin mind, from its nature spirit, from its identity soul, from its operation principle, from its method of life, from its ideal form of truth, and from its plan of love. So in the textbook, Mrs. Eddy said that the origin of laws would be God, the divine mind. That mind is the creator of spiritual laws. God creates its laws, conceived in the divine mind. And that the nature of spiritual laws are purely spiritual. They exist in reality itself, free of all human beliefs of the human mind. And that spiritual laws, their identity are that they're invariable. And yet these pure spiritual laws which are invariable, they are laws which govern changes. And the spiritual laws, they operate by themselves, as we've already seen in the, through the operation of the Christ. They are laws which operate whether the human mind takes cognizance of them or not. When we wake up in the morning, we don't have to set the laws of God in operation. They're operating, as I've said many times now, our responsibility as man is to get ourselves out of the way and through understanding come into harmony with those self-operating laws. And the method that these spiritual laws operate are always as the Word, out of themselves. They declare themselves to the universe. They operate through their own channel. They don't need any other channel to operate. They're not, according to spiritualism, that thinks you need other channels for things to operate. The laws operate through themselves, the Christ. They always operate as themselves, Christianity, and always for the glory of themselves, science. You see, they're free from any human interference. And the form of those laws are those laws which are always operating by themselves, out of themselves, through themselves, as themselves, and for the glory of themselves, are always operating holistically, always as the whole, always taking in the whole universe, including man, a whole that cannot be divided, a whole where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. They're always operating holistically, they're always operating structurally, and they're always operating dimensionally. They touch every level of conscious experience. And the big point that love brings in, that they always operate teleologically. They always operate according to a plan, according to a goal. They are goal-oriented. That's that sense of cybernetics, divine cybernetics. Laws that are always self-operating, self-organizing, self-regulating. They're error-preventing and they're error-correcting. They're always operating for the goal to bring out that pre-established perfection, that pre-established plan.